floors.
We go?
Nothing else.
Good. Okay. Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, September 25, 2008. First item on our agenda, we've got three presentations by the Legislative Auditor's Office. These have been previously released, and but this is our first opportunity to take a look at them. So, Ms. Ferkel, welcome to the Budget Division, and please proceed.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I'd like to talk to you today about three reports that we've released fairly recently. The first one is a report on internal control over financial reporting. The second one will be about the payroll and personnel system, the Semaphore system. And the third one is about a data integrity audit that we did for the information warehouse. And I'm clicking the button and nothing is happening here.
Oops. There we go.
Okay, there we go. The first one I'd like to talk about, it should be the top one on your list. It's report number 0802. It's a report on internal control over statewide financial reporting. And we issued that just a few weeks ago on February 11th, 2008. This report is an overview of the controls for the state's financial reporting process. As I'm sure you know, every year the Department of Finance prepares an annual financial report. Annual financial reporting has been seen and viewed as a key part of government accountability and fiscal integrity. It's something that's in the statutes, that's a requirement of the state. Annual financial reports are important to bond raters. It's one of the factors that they use to determine the risk faced by investors when they invest their money with the state. And lower bond ratings can result, which can be an additional interest expense if annual financial reports are not prepared. The state's Department of Finance is charged with preparing the annual financial report for the state of Minnesota. And the statutes require that they prepare this report in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Additionally, finance needs to have internal controls in place that are sufficient to ensure that they can achieve this goal. What we do when we audit is validate that the annual financial report has been prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And to do that, we also need to know that the controls that have been put in place by the Department of Finance are sufficient. When we make adjustments to the financial statements, that's evidence that a weakness in controls occurred. And what this report is about is the weaknesses that we identified in our audit of the fiscal year 2007 financial reports in that reporting process. One of the outcomes of Enron and WorldCom and the development of Sarbanes-Oxley has been changes in audit standards to address what had been seen as lapses in audits that had occurred in those organizations. And that has trickled down into government auditing as well. And auditors now have a greater responsibility to identify weaknesses in internal control and to report those weaknesses. That's what this report is all about. So the key finding in the report is finding number one. That's on page 5 of the report. And that key finding is that finances controls are not sufficient to offset some of the risks that are in the process that they use. And we summed it up into three elements of their process that we believe create a fairly risky environment for them to prepare financial statements in. One of them, and they are interrelated, so I'll highlight them each and then kind of explain what they mean. There are deficiencies in the accounting system, a decentralized reporting process, and also staffing and workload issues. What happens is that the state's accounting system produces data that's kind of the starting point for the financial statements. And then there are a significant number of adjustments and estimates and calculations that have to happen to get to the point that you prepare financial statements. In determining those adjustments and estimates, the Department of Finance works very closely with agencies that run the operations. So there is that decentralized factor. There's the Department of Finance creating the financial statements, but using a lot of information that's created, developed, estimated at the department's levels. In a decentralized process like that, communication and verification of that data is really key. So the Department of Finance's communication with agencies about what they need, about what what accounting principles they're applying, what decisions they need agencies to make, and then verification or validation that the information they got from the agencies is accurate and in line with what they need to report. Data that MAPS does not provide, MAPS is the state's accounting system, is generally information about accruals, whether they're the shorter term accruals that are reported in some of the statements or the full accruals that are reported at another level of statements. For example, in the medical assistance program, you can't go into the accounting system and find out what the payable amount is at June 30th. Similarly with school aids, and those require adjustments that are hundreds of millions of dollars that need to be determined based on estimates and calculations at the agencies, and that information then provided up to the Department of Finance. In the staffing area, we do not in any way contest that the staff, there's about six financial reporting staff at Finance, and they work along with scores of other staff at other agencies that also help in the preparation of the financial statements. And we believe these are knowledgeable, hardworking, dedicated people. We don't think that that's a part of the question here. But because doing the best they can is not getting the job done, there still are adjustments to the financial statements that we identify through the audit. We believe there are underlying staffing and workload issues that need to be addressed. There, as we've told you, and as you're aware, in the accounting and financial world, there's a significant amount of turnover. It's a good job market that tends to attract people away. Higher salaries outside of state government, that plays a part in state agencies. Also, we think that the agencies and finance need to improve their oversight and review of key calculations and of estimates that are made by the departments. As you go through the rest of the report, findings 2 through 10 really are more detailed information about the adjustments that we made, and they support our overall conclusion in finding 1, that there are these weaknesses in the process. Some of the findings deal directly with certain agencies, such as DHS, DNR, DOT, about weaknesses in their processes, but I do want to highlight that the Department of Finance has overall financial reporting responsibility, and although these are directed at specific agencies, finance would have overall oversight responsibility in how they get resolved. Another key finding is at the end of our report, it's finding number 11, and that is on page 13. And it's somewhat similar to finding 1 in that it again results from the deficiencies in the accounting system, the decentralized process in which the financial statements are prepared, and again, staffing and workload issues. The focus here, though, is just a little different. It's not the state's financial statements, not the comprehensive annual financial report, but it's the federal expenditure schedules that are reported to the federal government annually as a reporting mechanism for receiving those federal funds. Again, we found the need to make some significant adjustments to those schedules. Probably the largest of them was we found that $400 million had been omitted from the Department of Human Services schedule for the medical assistance program. Again, the accounting system, some of the deficiencies there have to do with federal dollars are not easily identified in the accounting system. There's no consistent recording or requirement that federal expenditures be identified or flagged in the system in a way that would allow you to summarize or extract that data. There's also difficulty linking programs together that exist at several different agencies or where one agency is subgranting money to another agency. And we found instances where data was double counted in both agencies. Communication and verification, again, is really key here where you're working in a decentralized environment. The Department of Finance did a great job in tying out those schedules to our audited financial statements and distributing them to the agencies to ensure that they were accurate, but when they came back from the agencies with adjustments, they didn't re-verify that the overall integrity of the statements had been ensured. Also, turnover, again, of key staff. We're seeing this more when agencies try to work with these single audit schedules that we're dealing from an audit standpoint, we're dealing with people at the agencies who are not familiar with the schedules. Sometimes they aren't sure where the information came from. They aren't sure what they're supposed to do with them. Sometimes they're asking our auditors, can you help me with this? And that's really not an audit role for us to be stepping in and completing the schedules. We also have heard instances where staff have left their jobs, just a couple years from retirement because of the stress of the workload of working in some of the departments. And those were the key people that had prepared those statements in the past. So now new staff are doing it. We're seeing more errors again. So that's a real high-level, quick overview of this report. Are there any questions?
Well, are there any questions, first of the auditor's office on this? I do have a question. I don't know if anybody from finance is here, but I'm curious. We've talked about upgrading the MAP system, and we had some patchwork funding last year. I mean, this seems to me to kind of make the case that, that system really does need attention if we don't really have sufficient controls over the accounting system. Is anybody from finance here who can talk about a response to the auditor's report? And welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Lori Moe. I'm with the Department of Finance, Accounting Services Division. Uh-huh. First, I'll make maybe a couple general comments about the findings that the auditor has identified. Mm-hmm. And then I'll address the MAPS upgrade issue. The findings I'll do as the Ms. Ferkel did and address finding one, the general finding, as well as the single audit finding.
And the finance response is on starting page 19 of the report.
Right. Our response to each individual finding is published with the report. In finding number one, I think you'll see that the auditor has indicated that finding is partially resolved. We made a number of changes and I think improvements to the system, which strengthened our process this year. But they have identified some areas where we still have a ways to go, and we have some ideas for ways to strengthen that process. I think it is a continuous process that we work on with the auditors, finding improvements to strengthen our process. In terms of the staffing issues that the auditor has raised, we appreciate the recognition that we have a really good crew that's working on these now. We have some plans underway now to do some cross-training with some other units in the agencies so that those people will be available to assist with the financial reporting process in the event we have unexpected absences or turnover in these positions, as we've experienced the last few years. In terms of the single audit, I really look at that finding differently. In the first finding, we've had numerous checks and reviews in place, and we have some areas we need to strengthen. But in the area of the single audit, we have been relying much more completely on agency action to make the adjustments necessary for the federal schedules. And we have designed and provided to agencies some additional tools to make that process more effective. But it's clear from the auditor's finding this year that what we need to do is add another level of review back at the Department of Finance when those schedules get returned. We also have on the single audit a timing issue, and we've talked to the auditor about a couple of ideas to make those some of that information available earlier. I don't think we've found the solution yet to move the reporting dates as early as the auditors would like to see, but we'll continue to work with them and look for first solution. In terms of the maps upgrade, certainly there are changes that would affect some of the findings here, but I don't want to people to be misled that a new map system would address all of the findings that are in this report. Many of the findings here relate to, as the auditor discussed, the adjustments and estimates that go into producing the financial statements. And while a new system we expect would replace some of the side systems that capture some of that data, it won't replace the need for the financial professionals to do much of the background work. And we have a presentation on the status of the MAPS replacement project scheduled later today.
Right.
So I'll hold off on that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the members? If not, Sarah Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading the recommendation for number 8, and it was one that was well publicized, where individual had received an inaccurate payment of $2.6 million, and there was an effort being made to try and recover that.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the one that was in the news?
Yes.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, and Ms.
Lori Moll.
Moll. Ms. Moll.
Yeah.
These types of problems are, hopefully, we don't hear about them very often, and they aren't happening regularly. Is there something in place that can catch these a little easier? Has this been reviewed in a different light of how on earth this happened, that somebody received an individual payment worth several $1 million?
Ms. Ball.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, yes, we have looked at that closely, both within the Department of Finance and talking with the agency where the issue occurred. I can tell you about the things we're doing for the short term, and then also I can tell you that particular problem is one that I would expect a new system to be able to address much more effectively. The error that occurred was certainly unusual for that size of payment to be made through a manual accounting entry, and for the verification process to fail to catch it. But what we've done is put a couple of additional controls in place and issued instructions to agencies for a requirement for an online approval process for payments that exceed $100,000. And then we also have another report available for agencies to review for any manually entered payment, a similar category of payment between $25,000 and $100,000. And those have been in place since the incident occurred last summer. We have recently begun evaluating the data that we've been capturing since then to evaluate how effective those controls are, and also to evaluate if the dollar threshold, if we drew the line in the right place, in other words. So I met last week with representatives from the agency involved, and they are doing those reviews internally as well to see how those controls are working. I would expect in a newer system that the vendor numbers, the identification number that identifies how that identifies each individual vendor would have a check digit in place, so that if there was a simple keying error, that it would pop up as an invalid vendor rather than match with somebody that was not intended to be paid.
And on page 28, you can see the actual Department of Human Services responses on this particular finding. Senator Roebling, you had other questions?
I'm wondering what the likelihood of recovery on something like this is. It was my understanding that the individual had already spent some of the money. And I just wonder, when an error like that is made, is the state isn't covered in any particular way. It is simply our loss if that is not recovered. Is that correct?
Well, it says that we are working with the Office of Attorney General and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office recording civil and criminal proceedings. But I think the chance of recovering the money is pretty slim. Ms. Mullen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, shortly after the incident happened, I had gotten some indication from the department that they were optimistic about recovering a fair portion of that, but I don't have numbers for you today. I'm not sure if there's someone here from Human Services that would want to address that or not.
Is there somebody from Human Services that can tell us the status of that? Please come forward. You need to get to the mic so you can get it on the recording here. Please identify yourself for the Budget Division.
Hello, my name is Dave Earhart. I'm the Director of Internal Audits for the Department of Human Services. And at this time, again, I can't tell the exact figures. I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but we probably have $2 million that's we've recaptured that's been in a holding process until the courts do their civil and criminal proceedings.
Okay. Okay. Does that answer the question? Thank you. Anything further on this report? If not, Ms. Ferkel has two others to present, and she'll be proceeding there. Ms. Ferkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move off that report, I do just want to say that the Office of the Legislative Auditor isn't taking a position necessarily on whether a new MAPS upgrade would resolve the issues or not resolve the issues, or whether it's needed or not. We're just working in the environment of the system as it exists today and the risks that system creates. If a new system reduces those risks, it may correct some of these errors. But we haven't been involved in the details of elements of the new system and how they might affect financial reporting.
But we have, so we do. That's why we ask the question. So thank you.
Okay, so now I'd like to move on to the report on the state's payroll system. It's Report 0701. It's a report on Semaphore Personnel and Payroll Controls. This is a report we issued about a year ago in January of 2007. Semaphore is a commercial software product that the state has used for quite a few years. About 3 or 4 years ago, they upgraded the system to a web-based application, and that resulted in some changes to the system that have some connection to the findings that we have. The Semaphore system processes about $3 billion worth of payroll annually for about 50,000 state employees. Our review of the system generally concluded that generally the state or Semaphore has good controls over the pay and leave accrual rates, that those are accurate in compliance with the bargaining agreements, and that biweekly payroll is completely and accurately processed and recorded in the state's accounting system. So those are really the big functions of what the system needs to do, and it's doing a good job of that. However, there could be some improvements in some of the controls. We found that the Department of Employee Relations had not developed a comprehensive plan and process to manage personnel and payroll risks. When they went to a new version of the software, one of the decisions that they made in the department was not to create a lot of customized edits in the system, particular to the state of Minnesota. I believe the thinking behind that was that if upgrades to the system were needed in the future, they wouldn't have to then customize all the upgrades. It would be a much smoother process for them. But we didn't think that they had really considered the risks that were created by that decision in the environment. For example, one of the edits that used to exist in the older system that now didn't exist was some validation of holiday hours. So maybe holidays could only be reported on certain days in the pay period or maybe to a maximum number of holidays in the year. When they took that edit out, errors that were made by employees or within departments weren't being detected. And what we see then when we come in and do an audit of an agency is some employees where in the pay period they perhaps charge 72 hours a holiday and 8 hours of regular pay. What they had done was just switch the hours around. They meant to do 72 hours of regular pay and 8 hours a holiday, but it got recorded an error in the accounting system. We're seeing that error and those types of errors when we go out and do audit work. What we believed that Duer should have done was considered what the risk was in taking out those types of edits and designing controls for agency personnel or for themselves to monitor whether or not errors were occurring. Another area that we believe some improvement could be made was that the controls over certain authorizations were not in place in the system. There are certain types of personnel transactions. For example, when you first hire somebody, they are to be placed within the first three steps of a range. And if you need to put their initial pay at higher than that, you need to get approval from the Department of Employee Relations. The system, however, will let you enter that person's pay at whatever place in the range that you want without knowing whether or not the system doesn't know whether or not you have that authorization. So that's just one example of that type of a transaction. What we recommended was that the department explore some opportunities within the system to automate some of those authorizations so that the system would force you to have those authorizations before you could process the transactions. Another area where we thought some improvements could be made was in the area of delegation of authority. The Department of Employee Relations has authority to delegate certain decision-making to department-level personnel, commissioners or HR employees within departments. But they really didn't have a rationale about who was qualified for that delegation and who was not. This is an area that we have seen fairly recently a new policy developed by the department that does outline certain criteria and certain skills and training that an employee would need to have before they are given that delegation. Similarly, we thought that the department could make some improvements in their monitoring of employees that have incompatible functions. Generally, we mean people that have the ability through the system to process human resource transactions and process payroll transactions. Those are incompatible because it allows you to establish an employee on the system and then also to pay that employee. We found over 120 employees that had incompatible access. And this, again, is an area that the Department of Employee Relations has developed a new policy and has become much more limiting in whether they will allow a department to have incompatible access for their employees. The policy pretty much said that no agencies could have incompatible access unless they're able to demonstrate that it's absolutely necessary for them to get their work done. Another area had to do with some programs and passwords, and you'll have to forgive me this finding, and the next one gets a little beyond my technical skills. But that the system stored certain account names and passwords in plain text or clear text within certain programs that a large number of people could access. My understanding is there are about 8 programs where this would happen and about 20,000 accounts would have access to that. This is an area that has been corrected. And the final one has to do with firewall rules that didn't sufficiently restrict attempts to access the database, the underlying data behind all the payroll and personnel activity. That's an access that's really only needed by a few IT people, and the system, the way the firewall was set up, Anyone with access to a government computer as part of the state's wide area network could make unlimited attempts to try to access the data. And again, this is an area that we believe that we've been told that it has been corrected. So that's kind of a high level of that report. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Sure. And could we just get verification? This report did come out about, well, slightly more than a year ago, but and you were, of course, in the process of merging into some other agencies. Do we actually know somebody here from DOOR or some other agency to tell us that the steps to on the restricted database, so only those people have access to the payroll database, you know, has that actually been corrected? The report only says that we're working with OET, so is that true that we've now corrected that? Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Steve Jorgensen. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Finance, formerly from Employee Relations, one of the folks that have been transferred in January. And the answer is yes, those corrections have been made.
Okay, so you feel that it's now secure so that the firewall is in place and we don't have people with unauthorized access to the payroll system?
Yes, that's correct. Security is always a constantly changing thing, and we appreciate working with the auditor and the things they bring to our attention. It's always good information. But yes, to the best of our knowledge, we are a secure system.
Okay. Any questions for the auditor or any other issues that's raised here? Appears to be none. Thank you. Okay, and the last report.
Last report is, again, a fairly recently issued report. We issued it in December of 2007, and it's an audit of the data integrity of the data within the state's information warehouse. This might be a little hard for you to see, but the data in the warehouse comes from three sources. It's the data collected through the payroll and personnel semaphore system, all the HR transactions and payroll transactions, along with all the accounting data and procurement data that exists within MAPS, the state's accounting system. The data from those transactions builds into tables, many tables within the state's warehouse. And it was this warehouse and the integrity of the data within the warehouse that we were examining as a part of the audit. We concluded that finance generally had adequate controls to protect the integrity and confidentiality of its warehouse data, but that finance could improve its security in three areas. We found that finance had few written policies, standards, procedures for securing the data warehouse, and I think the emphasis here is on written, that they had policies, they had standards and procedures, but they aren't written down. And in this environment with changing personnel and the desire to, you know, maintain a high level of standards and consistency in their application, having documentation of those standards is critical, and we felt that this was an important finding. We also found that finance did not always enforce strong password controls. That would be where, you know, the passwords have a certain degree of complexity and certain types of characters in them. For the most part, the passwords that are required of general users, like auditors in our office or agency employees, those are maintained at a strong level. But some employees who have powerful accounts, they're kind of the administrative type of people, their passwords, they're told to use strong passwords, and the system could be configured to require strong passwords, but that's not the case. So the system would allow them to use weak passwords, and we think that they should make improvements in that area.
How do you define strong and weak passwords?
A weak password might be your date of birth or your dog's name. A strong password would be random numbers and letters and characters like the pound key or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
And the last suggestion we had had to do with logging security events. That's when there's a attack on the system or somebody trying to hack into the system. Part of the problem is that you can be overwhelmed with the number of logs and the number of things that you can log that you can keep track of, and then how do you have enough staff to review all of those and make sense out of them. What we found right now is that not very much logging had been turned on or activated. And we think that the department needs to really assess where the main risks are in that environment and activate some of the logs and good log review processes over the things that they believe create the most risk for them.
Any questions? First, Sarah Olsen.
Were there any cases that you discovered of hacking or where security had been violated? Or?
Ms. Ferkel?
I'll have to ask one of my audit managers to address that.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name's Eric Wyan. I'm the IT Audit Manager for the Legislative Auditor's Office. And to the best of my knowledge, there were no known compromises of the system.
Mr. Wyan, how do you spell your last name, just for the record here?
W-I-O-N.
W-I-O-N. Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Ferkel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, we have presentations today from the Department of Finance and Department of Employee Relations. Finance will be first on our agenda. You may remember last year we spent a lot of time on technology issues, and so we wanted to get kind of an update on just where we were on that, not only on the accounting, the human resources budgeting that we talked about last year, but also in the final state government budget bill, we had some authorization for carry forward for technology money that the agencies could hold on to money. So we wanted to kind of find out where things were there. So let me just give a minute here while the projector is being adjusted or turned off or something here.
Mr. Chair, I could probably get started because I don't need that right away.
So. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for having us here today. We're going to,
we'll need
for
the
record,
too, yeah.
For the record, Stephanie Anders, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Finance. Commissioner Hansen can't join us today. He's at the Northwest Airline hearing and has a couple other commitments also, but sends his regards to you.
Thank you.
We wanted to give you a brief overview of the major projects that we've been working on. You heard from the OLA. You got a sense of the statewide nature of those projects, and just want to tell you where we're at on those. We're also going to give you a more in-depth presentation of the MAPS replacement system. And so I'm going to start off by giving you a little bit of an overview of the other three projects, and then we'll move into MAPS.
What do you have? Okay.
I have a couple handouts here.
Okay, we'll send.
The biennial information system project, the biennial budget system, as it's called, more what you're probably more familiar with hearing about, is really the primary tool for assembling the fiscal information and the biennial budget documents that you all work from as you're looking at the biennial budget. Starts out, our use of the biennial budget system usually starts out in the fall of a biennial budget year, and the current system that we use has separate modules for preparing the operating budget, the capital budget, and also for tracking fiscal notes. That system is pretty old at this point in time, where we've really been looking, had some concerns about the stability of the system, particularly as it relates to processing the Word documents within it. Our system contains both the fiscal information and also the actual narrative documents that, again, you're used to looking at with the biennial budget process. And we have some concerns, really, about whether or not how much longer we can sustain use of that system. So in December, we released an RFP to get some responses from vendors to look at a new system to prepare the operating and capital budgets. And at this point in time, our project team is currently working to evaluate this proposal. We worked really closely with agency staff and with legislative staff to develop project specifications for that biennial budget system. Mr. Lundin was involved in some of those conversations and has helped also to help us figure out going forward what are the key aspects that you all need to do your work, and also as we're putting together the budget for the executive branch. We're also, as we do the vendor demonstrations, those are planned for March. Legislative staff are going to be involved in looking at those demonstrations also. We have partial funding set aside through the IT carry forward. You'll be hearing a little bit more detail about that IT carry forward and the other elements of it, but we did set aside $1.3 million to get us what probably will be part of the way towards developing that new biennial budget system. And when we get going, the project length of that replacement is estimated to be 18 months.
Which means we're actually, it'll be in place for not next, the next biennial budget, which we'll start working on a year from now, but the following one, is that what we're...
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We anticipate if everything goes as well as it can, that we would still be using the old system for the next biennial budget and then the new one for the...
So 2012, we should be in great shape.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
A long lead time, Mr. Chair, in all of these projects.
Okay.
The fiscal note system is the next one I want to talk a little bit about. That's a tool that, as you well know, the executive and legislative branches use to develop and then report fiscal notes. It's a very iterative and collaborative process between legislative staff and agency staff and finance staff. Last session, more than 1,000 fiscal notes came through that system. We don't expect from the upgrade that we're looking at for you to be seeing a lot of changes. The materials that legislators will be working with probably won't change a lot other than perhaps format. The real changes that we're looking at in this redesign of the fiscal note system have to do with moving it to a web-based platform to stabilize the system. Also, it's kind of a garden-grown, homegrown system that has some pieces, again, that make us a little nervous for its stability going forward. Again, knowing how important it is for all of you to get your work done and to keep the legislative process moving along. We're in the preliminary stages right now of updating that system, and we plan, assuming that we're able to continue to do that, to use existing appropriations and to call on the expertise of existing DOOR and finance staff to do that upgrade. Again, we'd be working closely with legislative staff also to figure out, to make sure that we're hitting the right requirements for you as we do that. And our target for completing that system upgrade is would be for use in the next legislative session.
Okay.
Finally, you heard a little bit about the Semaphore system. It is the statewide system that processes and administers payroll and benefits for 50,000 state employees on a biweekly basis. Right now, we have an upgrade in progress, which is the fourth significant upgrade since 1995 to that system. We expect that this upgrade, which moves us from version 8.3 to 9.0, will enhance functionality. It'll help to maintain and keep us consistent with tax changes and, again, should help to stabilize the system. That project is paid for. It's a $3 million project paid for a combination of funds from our statewide systems billing, that funds that we bill to agencies, and then $1 million also from CGIP. The estimated completion date for that project is fall 2008.
Your slide says risks and benefits. Is that part of this the package?
That is going a good segue, Mr. Chair, to MAPS, and that is what I'd like to talk about next if there aren't any questions on those other projects.
Okay.
Then let me call up Assistant Commissioner Lori Moe from the Department of Finance and Ken Allen from the Department of Administration.
Okay, welcome back, Ms. Moe.
Thank you.
As some of you will remember, I was here last year when we were before you discussing a budget request for planning and contingency funding to continue the process of planning for an eventual MAPS system replacement. That is a statewide system that's approaching technical obsolescence, and we have been undertaking a number of activities to plan for its replacement. What we're going to do today is give you an overview of the current system, talk about the risks facing the current system, the benefits of a replacement system, and what the next steps in that process would be. With me is Ken Allen from the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration has responsibility for the procurement component of the MAP system, and admin and finance work as partners to operate the statewide system. MAPS itself stands for the Minnesota Accounting and Procurement System. It is a statewide system composed of software from two vendors, one for the accounting side of the functionality and the other for the procurement functionality. It's a statewide system that's used by 130 agencies, and there's over 2,000 users across state government. Sometimes I think there's been some confusion that this is the system that finance uses, but in fact, agencies throughout state government use the MAP system for tracking their accounting transactions. There are a number of cases where the agency's detailed level transactions are maintained in a subsystem that is specialized to their business area, and in those cases, the summary level data is then entered into MAPS. And I'll talk a little bit about more about interfaces later in the presentation. But as you can see on the list on the next couple of slides, and I'm sorry, I did have copies of the slides if people would prefer to follow along that way. As you can see on these next slides are lists of just some of the examples of programs that are accounted for within the MAPS accounting system. Payments and receipt transactions for nearly every program in the state, as well as agency operations. They range from adoption assistance to paying vendors for food deliveries at the zoo.
Excuse me, Ms. Moll, where it talks about motor vehicle services there, because in transportation, we're looking at a whole different system for them. How does this overlap?
We have numerous examples throughout state government where an agency has a specialized system within their agency to address their specific agency needs, and then there's an interface, an electronic communication between their system and the MAP system. And sometimes that means feeding quite a low level of detail into the accounting system. Sometimes it's a summary level transactions. But in all of those cases, we capture the data for statewide reporting within the MAP system. And we also combine transactions for more efficient processing in the areas of payments, tax reporting, printing warrants, doing EFT, electronic funds transfer payments, printing 1099 documents at tax time, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up?
So we'll see.
Ms. Moll, so then this isn't necessarily duplicating their system of records, driver's records and license and that kind of stuff. This is more maintaining their financial transactions. Am I understanding that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, that's absolutely right.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
As you can see as you're reading through this list that many of these transactions are critical programs, time-sensitive payments, transactions where it's essential to have a stable, reliable system and where there would be significant impact if the transaction processing was delayed. I'm going to turn it over to Kent now, who's going to give you some history on the development of the current system, as well as review the procurement functionality.
Mr. Allen, welcome back for the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Division Director for the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. I'm not going to belabor the history here, but do want to say a few things about it, particularly as it relates to where we are today. The state began planning for its MAP system in 1991, 17 years ago. And if any of us sort of ponder back on what the world of technology was like 17 years ago, it was really a pretty different place. Just for purposes of an example, one of my colleagues was researching what a cell phone was like in 1991 and found one that cost $3,900 and weighed 2 pounds. So this is the era in which the MAPS system, as we now operate it and live with it, was initially planned. The products that go into MAPS were picked in 1992. Again, this is in a point in time when the Internet was still in a state of infancy. So it really seems like pretty much ancient history in terms of technology applications. The strategy at the time was to pick what were viewed as very much proven and tested and reliable accounting and procurement applications. And so nothing at the time was even considered really cutting-edge technology. So you can imagine that what was proven and reliable and not cutting edge in 1991 can really be viewed as pretty clunky and old-fashioned today. The MAP system was implemented as part of the statewide systems project back in the early 90s. Some of the other parts of that project are what you've been hearing the legislative auditor talk about earlier today. The semaphore system was a part of that statewide systems project, implemented concurrently with MAPS. The information warehouse was as well. But the focus of what Assistant Commissioner Moe and myself are talking about is the MAPS piece, which is the piece in most the piece of, for which we have the most concern about its potential obsolescence. Just for the record, the total cost of that statewide systems project, including all of these components, in the early 90s was estimated at $35.8 million by the OLA when they did their final report on the project. Well, the state has done some continuing investments in MAPS since that time, but the fundamentals have remained pretty much the same. In 1998, there was one MAPS system upgrade done to accommodate Y2K changes. In 1999, a new component was added that deals with professional technical contracts and particularly the fiscal management side of those contracts. And then more recently, finance and admin have tried to compensate for some of the other deficiencies in MAPS by doing some sort of independent or separate side systems to support the functionality we would have liked to have in the accounting and procurement system. So, for example, we've developed an online vendor registration system. We've been able to do online reverse auctions. We've created a process through which electronic solicitations can be viewed on the Internet and downloaded by interested vendors. And vendors can now review payment information on the web. These are all things that we would hope would be integral to a current and contemporary system if the state's in a position to move forward with that. Let me talk a little bit, and I think this is the next slide now, Lori. Oops.
Not really.
But that's okay. You can either back up or stay put. Two things I want to say about the procurement system at a high level that explain some of the complexity of what we're dealing with. And start to get into a little bit of the discussion of risks that Assistant Commissioner Moe will take further. One is this notion that the accounting and procurement system are actually two separate applications from two separate manufacturers. At the time the state made its choice about accounting and procurement applications, these were the best products that we felt were available in the marketplace at that time. But we had to integrate those two systems in such a way that they share certain files, that they pass information back and forth in real time. One of the problems is that one of the accounting system is still is a viable product that's still in use by many government entities. The procurement system is one that really is no longer being worked on updates aren't being developed by the manufacturer. So particularly the procurement side of our integrated accounting and procurement system is very close to being out of date. Another issue that adds to the complexity of the situation the state's now in with respect to MAPS is the fact that the procurement system calculates state, county, and city taxes and automatically transfers those funds to the relevant tax authorities. That's a very unique feature of the state's MAPS system. To the best of our knowledge, we're the only state that has had to customize its system in order to have a process to pay tax to ourselves. So as we look at changes in MAPS to continue that function, we're looking at a considerable amount of customization in order to maintain that ability.
Mr. Chair?
General Sein.
Why don't other states do that? Or why are we going to continue to do that if other states don't do it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think within the Department of Finance and Administration, we've often asked ourselves the question as to whether what we're doing for ourselves is helpful or more trouble than it's worth. Lori can maybe address some of the issues as it relates to federal funds and some of the complexities that got us where we are, but you raise an excellent question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, as I understand the history, it was added as a requirement that we would pay our self sales tax on purchases for the benefit of then drawing the federal share on those programs where the federal government contributes to the costs. I don't know if other states are doing it. I think what we need to do again is, as we replace the system, look at the cost of that functionality and or the customization to build that functionality and determine whether the draw from federal dollars is worth the initial and ongoing expense of maintaining that customization. The OLA mentioned earlier, we've looked at a number of our customizations in various systems and have been asking ourselves the question, not just how much does this cost to do, but how much does it cost to redo every time we need to upgrade the system? And as the more we customize the system, the more difficult it gets to upgrade, the more expensive it gets to upgrade, the less often we do it, and the further behind we get. So it's an important question.
Okay. Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair and members, the slide that you see actually lists a number of the types of documents and transactions that get processed electronically through the procurement side of the MAP system. I'm not going to describe those in any detail, but just in a very general sense, agencies identify purchasing needs and develop related specifications, and then the procurement system facilitates a bidding process which leads to the development of contracts for commodities and general services. Agencies place orders against those contracts through the system. Just to give you some sense of the magnitude, approximately 200,000 orders per year and 500,000 payments per year processed through the MAPS procurement component. The system provides a little bit less support than that for consulting contracts or professional technical contracts. It really doesn't assist with the procurement process in the way that it does for goods and general services, but does capture contract data and encumbrance data that allows agencies to manage the financial component of professional technical contracts, particularly with the complexity of those often extending across fiscal years. And we process about 12,000 professional technical contracts annually through the system. If you have questions, I will answer them. If not, it's going back to Assistant Commissioner Moe to talk about risks.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. With all of this talk of computer upgrading Are you guys working with the Office of Enterprise Technology and coordinating things that way, or are you all kind of in a silo?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. We actually have a multi-agency team that's been involved with this from day one, and it includes finance and administration, employee relations, and the Office of Enterprise Technology. At both the sort of commissioner level of those agencies, we have a steering team, and at a more of an operational level within those departments, we have teams working on this together.
And I've looked ahead to the closing credits, and it does show OET as one of the partners. Go ahead. Ms. Moll. Commissioner Moll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The next slides talk about the accounting functionality, and I won't go into detail on the various modules that are used, but this is the, as I indicated earlier, the system that tracks the accounting activity statewide, and is the system that's the basis for the financial statements that was discussed earlier. It is the system that loads spending history into the budget system at the start of a budget cycle. It's the system, one of the systems that loads data into the information warehouse, another system you heard about earlier from the auditors. That's a system that's used by many agencies across the state to meet their financial reporting needs. And it's also the system that the administrative agencies use for statewide reporting. The system maintains the state's chart of accounts and the other thing I mentioned earlier is the interfaces with other agencies, which is also an important component of the system. If the example brought up earlier was the Department of Public Safety and Driver and Vehicle Services. Another example is over at Human Services, where you may have heard in other committees about the MMIS system or the PRISM system. There are various business processes that do the detailed processing, but then the transactions are summarized in the accounting system. We also have interfaces with all of the retirement systems and with MNSCU as well. I talked earlier about consolidating transaction processing for both payment processing and tax reporting. That is a way that we reduce the transaction costs considerably. So if a number of agencies are all making a payment to a given vendor, those are combined into a single payment and either printed or paid by EFT in one process. The next slides now are getting into some background information on why we've been looking at replacing the current system. And there's really three categories of risk that we have identified. One is the risks related to the computer sitting on everybody's desktop. As you heard earlier, this system was designed back in the early 90s. It's not, the current system is not web-based technology. There is software that resides on the desktop computer that communicates with the mainframe software. And there are limitations to what operating systems that desktop software will function compatibly with. We It was built when Windows 3.1 was the current version, and we have been successful in keeping it running with newer versions over the last years. But we know currently that the 64-bit version of Vista is not compatible with the desktop. One of the problems with not staying current with the desktop technology is that as new security functionality is rolled out, we're unable to take advantage of those features. So as you know, in your own computers, that the hackers keep getting smarter and coming out with new viruses, new ways of trying to hack into your system, and the operating systems try and keep up as well to keep those at bay. And so it's problematic to tell agencies and for our own access to not be able to stay current with the newest desktop environment. It may also be that agencies will be implementing other computer systems that require the new operating systems, and we could eventually get to a point where agencies would need to maintain dual PCs, one for operating their newer applications and an older one for maps. Similarly, we're following and monitoring risks on the mainframe. We have operating system issues on the mainframe as well. Currently, MAPS runs on a system at the Office of Enterprise Technology, and they upgrade operating systems there approximately once a year. And so we go through an extensive testing function and tuning and modifications if needed to keep the current MAPS system functioning in that environment. But the alternative down the road, if that no longer is viable, would be to isolate and maintain an older version of the operating system in a separate region of the mainframe and use that exclusively for maps. That's an alternative that would be high risk and expensive. But that is one of the alternatives that we were considering when we came before you last year and asked for funding for risk mitigation. The third category of risk is in the area of staffing loss. As baby boomers are retiring, as people are moving on to other opportunities, there's fewer and fewer people available that are trained and knowledgeable in this old technology. And so that will be a problem that will continue to grow with time. As we look at planning system replacement, we've also got some slides for you on the benefits related to a new system. I'll give that back to you.
I'm going to briefly talk about the benefits. The first is maybe obvious because it's sort of the flip side of the risks that Assistant Commissioner Moe was just describing. If we move to an upgraded or new map system, those risks with respect to compatibility with current technology, staff and vendors having the right skills, improved security and so forth, would hopefully be resolved. Two other areas, though, I think are worth at least a quick comment. I think any of you in the legislature who have asked finance or admin for data in the past have experienced at least occasional frustration with respect to what we're able to provide. And those of us in those two agencies and others as well share that same frustration when we aren't able to get the detail and quality of information as readily from maps as one would like. So one of the primary advantages that we think we could work toward, that we know we could work toward in a new system, is improved access to data. And then the obvious ramification of that is you can do better planning, analysis, and decision making. One area of this, as it particularly relates to procurement, I think we've made some good strides, and particularly in working with Office of Enterprise Technology in terms of developing standards, negotiating pricing, negotiating terms and conditions. But our success with all of that is really very closely tied to the quality of the data that we have, and we believe that with an improved or new accounting and procurement system, we really would reach a significantly more useful data quality that would in turn lead to better pricing on state contracts. And one very specific thing about information that I know is of interest to this group, because the legislature passed a mandate in the last session asking us to develop a searchable database online that would contain information regarding all state contracts and grants at a certain dollar level. And our strategy for implementing that requirement is that we've built the specifications for that online database into the draft RFP that we've developed for the MAPS upgrade or replacement. Then one last area where we think we can see some significant positive change is simply the efficiency of a newer system. Despite the fact that we have an automated state procurement system, it's still a very, very paper-intensive process. Again, remember, we're working with some fundamental pieces that have been in place since the early 90s. Our purchase orders usually get copied and mailed to vendors. Vendors can't routinely respond to solicitations electronically. We have forms that are mandated by statute and actual contracts themselves that end up being routed manually for signatures because we don't have a method to do that within the system. So clearly there's a major, major opportunity here for streamlining processes and re-engineering workflow. And we have tried to make continuous improvements, but again, the foundation of what we're working with is really the system that was developed in the early 90s and is certainly showing its age. So with respect to efficiency, we think we can do much, much better.
If there's no questions on that, I'll move on to the current status of the replacement activities and the next steps moving ahead. We have completed an update of our risk assessment to as we continue to monitor the risks I discussed earlier. We have developed a business case for replacement of the system. We have drafted or completed a request for a proposal document with the assistance of more than 100 subject matter experts from various state agencies. And most recently, we have done some site visits to go and visit some other states that have implemented solutions that we expect would be responsive when we publish an RFP. So we have visited three states representing three different software solutions and talked with them about their implementation experiences, their lessons learned, things that they would do differently, and then was also able to see from them a demonstration of how they're using the software. So from a user perspective rather than from the sales perspective that we will see from vendors when we get to that stage. We also have a group that's looking at improvements to enterprise reporting, which is one of the points that Kent alluded to. Since we were here last year, we have spent a small portion of the planning money that was appropriated. It was used for the site visits, and we expect that once RFP is issued that the remainder will be used to bring on a full-time project manager and also for some outside assistance in the evaluation and selection of the winning proposal. The RFP currently is on hold pending the forecast release and budget decisions. Once we have the green light to move ahead, the next steps would be release of the RFP, an evaluation and selection process that would take about 5 months, and then a system implementation, which is scheduled for 24 months. So a two-year implementation project is our estimate. We've talked about all of the administrative agencies are involved in planning.
Last year, when we were looking at this issue, I think the cost of replacing maps is around, I think, $50 million, something like that. I imagine the cost has gone up since then. Do we have any ideas where we're at?
One of the things that we've done in the last year is got updated estimates for the cost calculations, and we brought in a consultant from outside to help us with that, as well as did research on other states, and our current estimates are approaching $60 million.
Of course. And last year, members, the governor did not recommend funding for MAPS, and I think it's kind of hard to get a lot of enthusiasm in the legislature. You know, if the governor's not behind it, we'll have to wait to see what the supplemental budget holds. But I'd be quite surprised, you know, frankly, if we have a bad budget and there's now a push to put the $60 million in there. But at some point, I think this has got to get done. Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For motor vehicle services, they have approximately 8.5 million transactions that I think we could have a technology fee on, because their replacement cost is estimated at $48 million. So I was thinking a technology access fee of like 50 cents per transaction generates about $4.5 million a year. And it's a four-year implementation, so I'm seeing that we could almost pay for the system through that technology access fee. But is there any – you guys are more internal, though, aren't you? I mean, it's not anywhere – is there somewhere within your system there public would access and there could be a revenue – stream there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no. We have not identified a revenue stream that could be used for this project. We do, our customers basically are the state agencies. We do currently bill them for the operating costs of the current system, but any increase to that would be just a cut to agencies. It's not something that could be absorbed at this dollar level.
Sarah Olsen?
How about, I heard a lot of talk about transactions for purchase orders and those kinds of things with outside vendors. And you talked about a lot of snail mail and those kinds of things. With the volume that the state does, is there ways that you could say, you know, we're going to use a electronic system, but we're going to have a technology fee on that because we're saving stamps? But, you know, I'm just trying to think of ways to get some money here.
Aren't we all?
Mr. Chair, Senator, some states have charged vendors to register to receive notices of solicitations and so forth. So there may be some very modest amounts that could be raised that way. I would be leery of thinking that we could come anywhere close to the amount of money that we'd be talking about to develop a system like this through those types of fees.
If vehicle services, if there is a new system being able to install there, would that still be able to interact with this older system, or would there be some complications there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think regardless of the order in which those systems are replaced, that we're going to have some rework to do on the interfaces. But we expect that with the new system in any case.
Anything further on maps? Okay. We also have, we asked Department of Finance to give us an update on technology carry forward. This was a bill which I believe Senator Roebling had last year that allowed the agencies to keep the money at the end of the fiscal year or the biennium to for technology, normally, and carry it forward to still invest it later on. The bill itself wasn't rolled into the state government budget bill, but in the end it was part of the compromise conference committee report, which ultimately passed. And so we just kind of want an update where we're at on the carry forward of money. So welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Finance. I do have a brief handout for the committee to walk through the carry forward for technology issue, if we could pass that out while I address this topic. I appreciate the opportunity. Just want to make sure that everyone understands that we're shifting gears from literally the projects to the supply line of how do we get money to those projects. What was requested at in the last budget was the ability to carry forward unspent operating funds for purposes of, to dedicate those funds for technology purposes. What was enacted was a capped amount of $5.7 million that could be used for technology purposes. That amount was put into a pool and then was to be allocated out. What that helped us do was have some money to address some of the smaller and mid-level size projects. What it didn't address necessarily was the ongoing incentive structure of how agencies might save money, try to put money forward, and use that over the long term for planning purposes. But it certainly has been helpful. The $5.7 million was distributed in a number of different fashions. First, we tried to look for places where we could foster collaboration between agencies, either on a multi-agency or even statewide basis. Some of those projects are listed on the handout that you have. In addition, we provided funds on a pro rata basis based upon the amount of money that that agency was essentially carrying forward or had available for cancellation. That amount was substantially less, but it was still something that allowed agencies to make some incremental progress on smaller IT projects. An example of that is how the Board of Accounting and the Architecture and Engineers Board were able to use their carry forward to merge their licensing databases. It's not a particularly big project, but it is certainly something that needed some attention, needed some funding. And with the carry-forward amount, they were able to make some progress on that and make systems changes to merge those operations and hopefully gain more effective operations. The total amount, as I mentioned earlier, is $5.756 million. That was the amount authorized within the state government finance bill. There were separate appropriate carry-forward language that was made in the Health and Human Services bill, and then there are also individual carry-forward provisions in other bills that totaled about $32 million. The amount that was available or carried forward in the Human Services bill was about $20.6 million.
So has all the $5.756 million... has it been applied properly? Is it all out there, or is there still unspent money, by the way?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have notified each of the agencies upon fiscal year close how much was available to them for purposes of technology. That money was then moved into a special revenue account in the 200 fund and was to be used for those technology purposes. I don't have a at this moment, balance of what is left in those accounts, but certainly this was the purpose and all of those funds I think agencies appreciated the ability to use for technology.
Well, I have a hunch if the governor doesn't get it, we may be looking for it. So if there's any out there, I don't know. It's a rope. Did you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I saw. Any questions? Carry forward. Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay. Next, we have we want to get an update on the Department of Employee Relations, the merger, as well as the insurance overview from CGIP, and then we wanted to get a little bit more information on the state hiring freeze and travel policy that's been implemented. So, Commissioner, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again.
We will attempt. I know we are done at 2:30. Is that correct?
Well, we go to 2:45. So.
We do. Okay.
Yes.
Be in the
okay.
At 2:30.
Oh, we do. Oh, is that? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. We recessed the Senate, but till 2:30 or so. But from what I can tell, the House is still in session and debating. So I don't know that there's anything that's going to call us to the floor. So. Go ahead, Commissioner Crane.
Okay, thank you. We will we'll try to be as quick as we can to save
sure.
enough time and get through everything in 20 minutes. I am Pat Anderson, Commissioner of Dewar, and I have with me Nathan Morocco. He's the Director of CGIP, and he'll give a brief overview about CGIP after I finish. I'll try to touch on the issues that you've asked us to speak about. That's the status of the merger, an overview of the hiring restrictions that were announced last week, and a very brief discussion about state travel policy. I'll start with the merger overview. As you know, there was legislation last year that passed, I think it was nearly unanimous, at least in the House, to merge Dewar in with three other agencies. That's the Department of Finance, the Department of Administration, and the Department of Health. And I'm pleased to announce that the parts of Dewar that are to be merged into Health and the Department of Administration are complete as of this date. We did move the Center of Healthcare Purchasing last summer into the Department of Health. We moved our workers' comp division, which was 34 employees, plus some other folks, into the Department of Administration late last year. I think it was December 12th. Since that time, we've also transferred some what I would call non-functional division staff, some of our fiscal staff, our IT staff, into the Department of Finance already. They had been working together, and now they're even though they're still essentially on our floor, they're all working together. We thought that was the best way to handle this with finance because essentially the final merger will occur near the end of May, and it will just be the three functional divisions which are left, which are CGIP, which Nathan will talk about, labor relations, which does bargaining agreements and so on, and compensation, and our HR division. So what you will have left is those three divisions and myself. Our assistant commissioner has already left also. So I'm essentially managing those three divisions. So the merger has been going very well, very smooth, and will be completed on time and on schedule. Mm-hmm. I'll go over the others very quickly. Hiring restrictions, as you should have a copy of both the memo from the governor and the memo from Commissioner Hansen and myself.
Yes, we do.
Out to the
yes.
agencies. This is the that memo talks about how we intend to implement the hiring restrictions that were announced. As you know, these are we have a budget deficit. We expect that deficit to get worse. So these are really a way for agencies to begin tightening their belt because we know we're going to have to do a lot of belt tightening around here over the next year or so. The policy really is about leaving non-essential positions vacant. So vacancies filled as folks retire or leave state service, not filling those vacancies. But there is a process for commissioners to ask for an exception and to fill things that they may not be deemed essential positions by definition, but that they feel are essential to be filled. That's how the hiring restrictions are going to be implemented. There is no end date. I think a lot of this will be determined by what happens this session and so on, what the budget deficit does state. Very quickly, I'll move into the final issue you've asked me to talk about, which is the travel policy. The state agency, or the state's travel policy, is that myself has to approve all international travel. Travel within a state or within the United States is approved at each separate agency. regarding international travel, about half of it's to Canada, many of it right over the border, and it's mostly the Ag Department and DNR. And I would say that the Department of Tourism is probably the second largest international travel entity. There isn't a lot of it, though, but it does go through me, and I question it. I deny some, there was a memo that I sent out in November of last year that reminding agencies that, especially in these budget times, they need to really think through whether any travel is necessary and to really think that through before it occurs. So that is the straight travel policy. It hasn't essentially changed in the last year. It's the same as it's been throughout this administration, but we do have fairly tight restrictions on international travel, which, again, does come through DUR. Before I turn it over to Nathan, I can take questions on those.
I've got a few
issues.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. First of all, I guess congratulations on your recent status.
Thank you.
Okay. On the travel, what prompted our interest, of course, was may have been just an isolated matter over the Department of Transportation, but I think we wanted to get some assurance, at least within our budget area, that the departments were actually closely monitoring, travel requests and so forth, and making sure that there weren't any more problems that, were going to come to our attention. So are you aware that have there been steps taken to make sure that there's closer monitoring so that, this is not being repeated, what happened in MnDOT?
Mm-hmm. I think the MnDOT case was a horrible thing that occurred, not only from a fiscal perspective, but also just as a very black mark on state government. And I think one of the positive things that's going to come out of that is that it gave everyone a reminder that they need to be watching these things much more closely. And that alone, I hope, will help serve that purpose. There is no entity besides the supervisors that signs off on these things. It's not the same as with international travel. And I don't have dollar figures. I can't tell you. Maybe the Department of Finance can, but I can't tell you specifically what's spent on travel domestically.
And I think the auditor was still going to go back and do some more reviewing of other things in MnDOT, so there'll still be more information on that to come, I guess, on that one. But I guess, as I say, we just need to be aware that there's not any other abuses happening.
Yeah.
On the travel freeze, it also strikes me that there may be some seasonal positions that some agencies go through, and they hire people perhaps like the Department of Revenue may hire a lot of people for just seasonal work, certainly DNR. How are they affected by the freeze on the hiring freeze? Because obviously, it's one thing to freeze the year-round positions, but when you have to hire a bunch of people for a short period of time, that may really mess up some of our missions.
That's right, Mr. Chair. We hire a little over about 500 seasonal folks every year. A lot of it's in DNR also, because a lot of the park folks are seasonal. It's been portrayed as a, quote, freeze, and I suppose from the public's perspective, it looks that way. This is a travel heavy restriction on hiring. It's actually a restriction. Seasonal positions aren't considered essential in our definition, but certainly they will be given sort of a blanket, okay, we know we need to hire people to run the parks. And those do come through DUR. The commissioner needs to sign off on those, and I'm sure we'll be hiring seasonal folks just as we have every year.
Does it affect retirements for the freeze or whatever? In the military, they can actually force people to keep working, and not let them retire, but I guess we can't stop people who want to actually retire. But what happens then? Do you get the exceptions if somebody actually does put in their retirement papers?
Senator Betzel, we've had higher turnover in recent years because of the retirement issue.
Right.
We have a lot of folks reaching that. There isn't anything specifically that it would affect, but I suppose that agencies may want to entice their folks to hang on a little longer. I don't know how there isn't any way to do that except to beg, but that would be probably the only way I would see that occurring. We are, as working on We're also doing some heavy workforce planning within state government, and we're working on, it's unrelated to this, but we're working on trying to get more folks to come back post-retirement part-time to just keep some of that knowledge and to be able to transfer that to sort of the next generation of folks that we're going to be hiring.
Okay, before we go to see if any questions of the commissioner on the merger or the hiring freeze or travel policy, Senator Wolstein.
Ms. Anderson, are you effectively working yourself out of a job then? Or
I think
you?
That was the plan.
Senator Olson, I am, and it's in statute even.
Yeah.
So.
When you said that's in May that that's done? Or
The merger is to be complete by June 1. In discussing all of the issues, we have just about everything done except for the final three divisions that are going into finance. The session should end before that, and so we're timing near right after session ends. There's a lot of issues, as you know, especially related to what's going to occur with a lot of health care issues out there, and we do run the state employee group insurance program. I'm on the health cabinet, and we thought it might make sense to wait till the end of May, which is still before the deadline.
And do we have any idea what the savings might be for the hiring freeze, or is that still being calculated?
Senator Betzel, we haven't even begun to calculate. It's pure speculation. If you would think that, you know, we maybe have 3,000 positions turnover and 20% are essential, there's going to be some exceptions. That doesn't include your seasonals.
Sure.
It would be, you know, how many of those and then how long, too. That's in a 12-month period, so it's really speculating. I think the idea is we know that we're going to have a deficit. We know that all the agencies are going to be affected in one way or another, and we should get started now rather than get started in June to try to make the budget balance internally within our own departments.
Sir Roebling.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson, when you are no longer with DOER, there's no longer a DOER, and you're the current person to approve, say, international travel, where will that responsibility fall after the department is gone?
Senator Roebling, that particular duty will fall with the Commissioner of Finance. There is a called the cleanup bill that'll be before you this session that was actually in the last legislation to get this done, but those specific things will be delineated. Most of them will be within the Commissioner of Finance website.
Thank you.
Most of the things we're doing are not, quote, going away. They can't go away. We still have to deal with labor contracts and other issues. They're just being combined, and it'll be much more effective. As you've seen today, most of the things we do, the systems we work on, we'd work with finance now currently. Our staffs work together, and so this is just simply putting a few hundred people together under one entity.
Sir Roebling.
Applications of the employee contracts come through this committee, too?
They will? Well, apparently they will, yes, because they do have budgetary implications. They've already been through the Employees Relations Subcommittee, you know, part of the Rules Committee, and then it's been through state and local government operations that you and I serve on. It does have fiscal issues because, as you know, we appropriated 3% money for 3% pay increases, but the contracts were approved at a slightly higher number. So it does have some things that I think finance needs to see, and it comes through here to get to finance committee. So we'll see that.
That was my question. Yeah. I didn't know if I should ask any questions about that now, but I can.
We'll get the bill later. Before us. Senator Metzen's carrying the bill. We'll see it at some point. I don't know when. It's on its way here somewhere, I guess. Any other questions of the commissioner?
All right.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, following up on yours, I was on a county board looking at pretty substantial budget cuts, and we were looking at similar things, but we knew pretty much exactly how many openings there were and, you know, could calculate, you know, the salary in that position and have at least a rough number of, you know, what the savings would be. So could, once you guys have a rough number, could you maybe forward it to this committee?
Commissioner?
Senator, also Senator Betzel. I understand where you're coming from. The issue is that these are not current open positions. These are positions that would become, you know, maybe a few of them are, but they're positions that may or will become vacant over the whatever period that hiring restrictions are on. We don't know who those people are. We don't know. People leave. People are transferred. People are retired. We don't know who they are. And we don't know for sure. We could guess based on past years how many may become. But it's such speculation that you would have a very large, broad range guesstimate. Plus, we don't know how many will be applied as exceptions to the hiring restrictions. So it's very difficult to give you a number.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody leaves, you know, their job may or may not be filled. So, okay, let's get a report on SEGA. Welcome back to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Nathan Morocco. What I thought I would do, certainly in recognition of the time, I want to offer as much as I can at the end for questions, but I thought I'd give a real quick overview of our program, focus a little bit on the medical program, which is certainly the most significant piece and I think what people mostly associate with us, talk a little bit about reserves, a little bit about our pre-tax benefits, and then Q&A. So I'll try and do that in about 5 minutes, if that's all right.
Sure.
The State Group Insurance Program, known as CGIP, which is a program that you also fall under, covers about 115,000 lives. That includes about 50,000 employees, their dependents, and it also includes retirees. It provides benefits for all three branches of government, as well as some quasi-state agencies. This includes MNSCU as well, and it covers some smaller organizations like Historical Society, which we don't always consider to be agencies, but are part of the CGIP program. We offer a comprehensive insurance products, including the health, dental, life, disability, long-term care. But certainly by far the largest program is the medical program, and that's branded as the Advantage program. So if you hear me use the word Advantage, that's the medical program. And that represents about a half a billion dollars annual claims experiences. So let's talk a little bit about the Advantage program. The Advantage program is the cutting-edge, nationally recognized program. It was established in 2002, and it's really based on a cost-tiering system by where we rank clinics by both cost and quality, and then we differentiate the program at the service. Essentially, between our tiering mechanism and our health risk management initiatives that we have a very comprehensive and progressive program. We do a lot of disease management and case management work, and much of that you are familiar with because you experience that yourselves. With the Advantage program, we'll talk a little bit about the reserves. The reserves are authorized in 43A to serve that the program and to ensure that the program is able to pay its claims when costs exceed revenues. The reserves are part of the bargaining process. When we talk about what we're going to offer in terms of insurance, what potential premium increases are going to be existing for the next biennium for the contracts, we do talk about the reserves, what levels that they're at, how we can either spend those down or how we need to increase those. So it's part of the overall premium increases that we look at. And unfortunately, in the medical arena, it always is about premium increases. We have never experienced a negative year in terms of premiums for medical. I think you're all aware of that there has been instances recently in 2005 where the reserves have been looked at in terms of being a potential revenue source. I just want to talk a little bit about that. In 2005, when $23 million was taken out of the reserves and appropriated into the general fund, that did have some implications. The federal government has a stake in the reserves because many of the dollars that feed our reserves as part of our premiums from the agencies, some of those dollars do come from federal grants that are paid to the states, which are then subsequently paid out as part of premiums from the agencies. The federal government has a very strong policy that says whenever money is taken out of an employee insurance reserve for any reasons other than the benefit of the program, the federal government does have to be repaid. This was something that we had suspected at the time that the money had come out in 2005, but it wasn't until about a year later and after negotiating with the federal government and working with the Department of Finance that we resolved the issue that we did have to repay the government back. So essentially it's about 14 to 15% of the dollars that are taken out of the reserve need to be repaid back to the Department of back to the federal government. And in the most recent case, that amounted to about $5 million additional monies that had to come out of the reserves. Let's see. So, as I mentioned, the reserves and the premiums are something that we discuss at length as part of the bargaining process. Certainly, the unions have expressed some concerns about the reserves and the levels at which it should be at. And so, as part of the bargaining process, what we had done in setting the rates for the upcoming 2 years is that we had recognized in bargaining that at the time we bargained, our reserves were about at 18-19%. So we like to be more around the 17% level. So we took into consideration that increased contingency reserve and set the premiums for 2009 at the point at which we felt that we would actually be spending some of those reserve dollars down, getting us closer to the 17%. And that's where we would expect to be by the end of calendar year 2009, which obviously is slightly different than your fiscal years. Some of the other programs, in addition to health, obviously I mentioned the dental, some of the disability programs. It should be noted that premiums and contingency reserves are really a combination of both employer dollars, employee dollars, depending on the plan and the coverage level. Sometimes it's all employee, sometimes it's all employer. Many times it's a combination of both. So the reserves are not only agency dollars, federal dollars, but they're also employee dollars as well. Moving on to the pre-tax accounts. The pre-tax accounts would be the medical dental expense accounts, the dependent care expense accounts. People have from time to time have asked me how those programs work. Essentially, they're all employee dollars. The employee gets a pre-tax benefit by where the money going into those accounts is reduced off their gross income. And people have asked me, what happens to that money? How is it paid out? Essentially, we pay the claims as the employees submit them. And typically, there is some leftover money from the pre-tax accounts. In the last fiscal, or actually calendar year, it was about $100,000. So it's not a lot of money. But those dollars are directed back into the program to keep administrative costs lower, or if we wanted to look at expanding functionality, we could certainly do that. But the federal government, under Section 125, highly regulates the pre-tax programs. We're not really allowed to spend or move those dollars in any direction other than the program, which does vary a little bit from what we can and can't do on the medical side.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Sir Holstein.
Do you do some kind of notification to people that they have money left in their account? I mean, that's their money, basically.
Sure. Yes, we do, actually. Most of the pre-tax accounts are administered by a third-party administrator, Ide Bailey. And certainly as part of that, there are notices that talk about what your account balance is, how much you've contributed year to date. And this is a really critical time for that because essentially folks have about 1 week to submit any claims for all of 2007, and whatever is not submitted by the end of February will essentially be defaulted. But certainly keep in mind that the pre-tax accounts are multi-million dollar accounts. I don't have the exact number, but I know that it's well in the millions. And only about 100,000 is defaulted each year. So employees are very conscious about those dollars.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe I'll just sort of stop there and leave it open for questions, given that we're almost out of time here today.
So. Yeah, are there any other questions here? Well, if not, thank you, Mr. Rocco, and thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And members, I gave you a list of the bonding proposals that I forwarded to the Capital Investment Committee. This is how you voted, we ranked them, and that's what went there. Not a lot of folks voted on amateur sports projects, so there just wasn't a lot of data I could forward there. But you have the list exactly as you voted on them. So it's about 2:30. You haven't missed anything. The House is still debating, so we'll go up to the floor and see what's going on.
Mr.
So,
Chair,
we'll see.
If the MnDOT building comes out of transportation, then then that becomes a mute point, I suppose. But
yeah, well, it's
Department of Administration is the one that has responsibility for, you know, the upkeep of the buildings. It was put into place, I think, as Commissioner Badgerow said, they try to, some of these high-priority things, they try to give them as many places as possible because they don't know which ones. But, you know, we're not going to redo the surface twice. So, but I think it was the same proposal that was under consideration in the bonding bill as well as what was in the transportation bill.
And then a follow-up. Yeah. The state capitol building repair at $15 million. It's interesting that the capitol was number one. Would that drop off also?
Well, no, well,
I thought those were going to be kind of combined.
Yeah, well, I tried to combine them, but we just had some confusion in the voting. But you can see that clearly the consensus of this budget division was try to do a Senator Rust proposal, but and the emergency fix was a little bit lower down. But either way, they're both high up. But Senator Langseth and the Bud Capital Investment Committee still have to work all these numbers in with an overall target. And, you know, they wanted our input. They've got our input. So that's the, as far as we can go on it. So
thank you.
Anything further? Okay, well, let's head up to the floor. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.